I'm Dave Cawley, investigative journalist and host of the podcast, Cold. In October of 1985, a woman named Cherie Warren left work at a busy Salt Lake City office
to meet her estranged husband at a downtown auto dealership.
She never made it home. Cherie's car surfaced weeks later in Las Vegas.
In the parking lot of a hotel casino.
No one knows how it got there.
Strange. It was strange.
Both Cherie's estranged husband and her boyfriend raised suspicion for investigators.
I kind of thought that he might have done something.
But no arrests were ever made. In Cold Season 3, we dig into double lives, make new connections in the case, and examine the difficulty raised by reasonable doubt.
We want answers just as much as anyone else.
They have creeps like that now too, so nothing's changed.
That's the new Cold Season 3, The Search for Cherie. Now available anywhere you get your podcasts.
Inside Sources.
Inside Sources.
America's voice of reason. Boyd Matheson.
On Utah's home for elevated conversation.
Inside Sources on KSL News Radio.
In the next half hour, the House of Representatives is expected to take a procedural vote on the rule that would actually put the debt ceiling bill, the compromise bill, on the floor of the House. We'll be watching that as we go through the next hour to see how that plays out. And then, of course, it will go on to a full vote if that procedural hurdle gets cleared to look at a vote on the final passage later on this evening. Now, there are many on the Democratic side of the aisle who have some heartburn over a number of things, and one of those in particular has to do with work requirements for some of those social safety net programs like the SNAP program. The interesting thing is this really began as sort of a hard red line for the White House when they began negotiations, became a little softer. There's a few things in there now, and there are some Democrats who are quite furious that the president crossed the line in terms of allowing some of those work requirements to go in. Interestingly, there is a political figure who spent decades demanding work requirement for these programs. Who was it? Let's find out. Let's begin.
Think you know the news of the day? Think again with Boyd Matheson on KSL News Radio.
Well, to answer the question, we're really grateful to have back on the program Angela Rashidi, senior fellow with the American Enterprise Institute, Rose Scholar in Opportunity and Mobility Studies. That's an important part of this whole thing with work requirements. Angela, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Boyd. Nice to be with you.
So as we look at this work requirement, you sort of laid out the idea of which president may have been the most firm on that. Give us a walkthrough.
Well, so your listeners might be surprised, or maybe not so much, given the lead in that the supporter of work requirements who is president is actually our current president, President Joe Biden. And it dates back to his time in the Senate, really in the 80s and 90s, when reforms to the then cash welfare program were in full swing. Debates over what was appropriate for that program was in full swing. And then Senator Biden actually came out very strong in favor of work requirements. And he used a lot of the language and narrative that I think you hear Republicans using today about the dignity of work, that government handouts don't give people opportunity to move up the income ladder. And so it's just kind of interesting to think, it is 25 years later, but the president certainly has changed his story now.
Yeah, so interesting. You mentioned in your piece that that President Biden was one of 78 senators, including all Republicans and more than half of the Democrats, who voted in 1996 for the welfare reform law and having that in there. As you look at the president's trajectory over that, what is it that you see in there in terms of, hey, maybe this is something we ought to be having a different kind of conversation around? It seems that what used to be sort of a requirement from the president when he was in the Senate and what the Republicans are now saying is pretty congruent.
It is, yeah. And I think what's happened over time is the narrative has changed. It's been over years, kind of more progressive policymakers have portrayed work requirements as somehow being punitive, being a punishment on poor people for being poor, when in fact that was never the intent behind them. And much of the language in the 90s was not so much about that. It was about, you know, how harmful government dependency can be and how it does kind of trap people. You know, a lot of times people can, you know, despite their best intentions, can feel trapped in these programs. And so a lot of the language at the time was around, how do we change that? How do we ensure that government is not actually harming people, that we're trying to give people a hand up and not a handout? And so I think that language is consistent among some people today, but certainly it's been kind of overshadowed by some of this other language that, you know, portrays work requirements as something that they are not and never were really intended to be.
Yeah. And I think that's such an important point, Angela. And I love the way you frame all of this and the way you go about the work, especially in that space of opportunity and mobility. I think that's the important thing for us to remember that, you know, one, the worst thing a government can do is give you exactly what you need to stay exactly where you are, as you were talking about being trapped in that. Or if we just start treating people like liabilities to be managed, as opposed to human beings with infinite potential to become what they want and have their own version of the American dream. And so we want to transcend the politics we get. We understand how that plays out. But to me, the more important part of this is both social commentary and then also the principles, the policies around that. And so as you look at it from your study standpoint, what is it that we should really be thinking about if we were really going to have an honest conversation about government programs, recognizing government does have a role to play in all of this at some form or another? What is it that we should be looking at? What kind of conversation should we be having that maybe even President Biden could lead out on?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I think that it does come down to kind of what our philosophy is and what our philosophy around the role of government should be. And I think overwhelmingly, I mean, even if you just look at recent polling data, like in general, people believe the government does play a role, as you mentioned, but that it should be a safety net, that there needs to be this reciprocal relationship where people, you know, try to provide for themselves and their families first. And if they fall on rough times, they can turn to the government on a temporary basis. The government should, you know, provide that temporary assistance, but also help them to get back on their feet. And I think that's where the president can really lead. And some of his narrative, you know, a quarter century ago was around that. He used the language like, you know, a hand up, not a handout, because he seemingly at the time, at least, recognized that government, while it plays a role, it does need to be temporary and it needs to be helpful and not holding people back. And so I think that, you know, I kind of wish that the Democrats over time had adapted more of that kind of language instead of just presenting kind of the other side as being, you know, punitive and trying to hurt people and take things away from them, which I think they have been somewhat successful in portraying that picture. But in my view, I don't think that that's really what this debate is about.
Yeah. And so as you look at what is actually in the bill, what actually would it do in terms of work requirements if this gets passed tonight?
Yeah, well, and that's the interesting thing, because it doesn't actually do a whole lot. and so that's what's interesting about just the backlash, you know, from those on the more on the progressive side of the political spectrum, because the debt ceiling, what it does do is there's currently a work requirement in the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, which is SNAP. We call it SNAP, or it's the formerly the food stamp program. So that's the big food assistance program. There's currently a work requirement, but it's very narrowly targeted. It covers people 18 to 49 who are able-bodied, meaning not disabled, who don't have children in the household. We know that that's only about 10% of the adult SNAP population. Mm-hmm. So that goes up to age 49. What the debt bill does is expands that up to age 55, just for that narrow population. So it will cover an additional maybe 2%, 2 to 5% of the SNAP adults population. Mm-hmm. So very, you know, pretty minor. I wouldn't say meaningless, because I think it's important to recognize that those are also prime age people and work should be a component of SNAP for them.
Yeah.
But still, it's very narrowly focused and doesn't cover a whole lot of the SNAP population.
Yeah.
So that's kind of the one big change. The debt bill also includes some changes on TANF, which is the cash welfare system that still exists. Again, it's a pretty small it's a program that targets a pretty small population, and they're somewhat tightening up the work requirements that have been eroded pretty extensively, to be honest, over the last decade plus. They're just kind of tightening that up a little bit and holding states accountable for actually engaging TANF participants in either work or work training. So in the end, again, pretty minor tweaks to the work component, although I don't want to diminish them because I do think they're important, but the reach of them is fairly limited, which is why it's interesting that it's gotten so much headline. So it's been in the headline so much because it really is a fairly minor change.
Yeah, super, super small, but hopefully it's the beginning of a different kind of conversation around this. As you said, Angela, it really is one of those that has been so distorted by the politics of it all that we're missing the real conversation about the principle and the policy, which is what we have to get back to. And Angela, I want to have you back on the show to dig into some of those things from your research that really show us what that upward mobility path looks like, how work requirements play into that. And but we appreciate your perspective on this today. As you said, it's way overblown. It's a very small piece, a very small baby step of baby steps in this particular bill. But there's been a whole lot of brushback just from the politics of it. But always appreciate your perspective. Angela Ricchitti, senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute and the Rose Scholar in Opportunity and Mobility. Angela, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Great perspective there. Again, all of the blowback on this work requirement it's so small. Not insignificant, important for sure. But the Senator Joe Biden, who was always adamant about having a work requirement so that you could get people on an upward path. And again, able-bodied, no dependents. This is a very small 10% or less of those of receiving these kinds of assistance from the government. And so we got to rethink that. The headline, if you look at it, you'd think this work requirement was something that was impacting the vast majority of recipients and the vast majority of Americans. It just isn't. That's all politics, which is why we have to get beyond the headlines and get down to the actual policies and the actual principles underlying it. We'll be right back.
Think again on Inside Sources with Boyd Matheson.
It's the story of an American held in a dark Venezuelan prison.
Then all of a sudden they all kind of lined up. They pointed their guns at me. And this is the point where I thought, I'm going to die today.
I'm Becky Bruce. I spent a year working on Hope in Darkness, which now has more than 2 million downloads. Find it on KSLpodcast.com or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Boyd Matheson divides rage from reason on Inside Sources.
Well, China has recently announced plans to land people on the moon by the end of the decade, 2030. This has set off some alarm bells, predictably, in Washington, D.C. Some who worry that a new space race is about to be launched, or maybe it's already been launched. So the question is that the reality? What are the latest developments between the U.S. and Chinese space programs? And why is this a crucial thing for those of us here on planet Earth? And I'm really pleased to have back on the program someone who is always ready at a moment's notice, Olivier Knox, a national political correspondent for The Washington Post. And, of course, we count on him as the anchor of the Daily 202. Olivier, welcome back to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
I know you're always ready for launch, regardless of what gets communicated to you, and we appreciate you jumping on. So talk us through in the Daily 202 today, you talked about worried about China. The U.S. is starting to lay out some space diplomacy goals. Give us a little sense of that.
Yeah, it's interesting. So the State Department basically put out what I think is not really news, but it's interesting to see all of these different elements in one place. They call it the Strategic Framework for Space Policy. It's an effort to sort of define America's interests when it comes to space policy, describe some of the means through which those interests will be advanced, and it serves as the latest warning from the federal government about the extremely hot rivalry between the United States and China. So, you know, one of the things that they do is they recycle the Director of National Intelligence's 2023 warning that China's advancing its own space policy interests, quote, with the intent to match or surpass the United States by 2045. They further quote the DNI, Admiral Haines, as saying, quote, China's space activities are designed to advance its global standing and strengthen its attempts to erode U.S. influence across military, technological, economic, and diplomatic spheres. So this is in large part a way of looking at the rivalry with China through the lens of space policy. And it's pretty interesting. Again, it's not so much that they made a lot of news with this thing. It's just that seeing it all in one place made for very interesting reading for a dork like me.
Yeah. Well, it was a major payload. Everything got packed into that thing. And we know on Tuesday they sent a crew, including its first civilian, up in. And so kind of walk us through that in terms of what they have been doing, what they are doing. And again, let's put it in the context of everything that you put into that payload there in terms of what it means politically, economically, and so on.
Sure. So, China has not been quiet about its advances in rocketry and in space technology over the last three decades or so. The U.S. Congress passed a law a while back effectively forbidding Chinese astronauts from working on the International Space Station, the ISS. So basically, astronauts from anywhere else are welcome. The Chinese were not. And one of the things that did is that it led the Chinese to build their own space station in Earth orbit. So now China is the only individual country to have one. I'll butcher its name, Chang'e. That apparently translates as Heavenly Palace. It is perpetually crewed. So they sent those three astronauts up. They're going to overlap with the three astronauts who are currently on board, but those folks are going to cycle back down to Earth. China is the only country to land a spacecraft and launch a rover on the far side of the moon. As you noted in your intro, they have announced plans to land people on the moon by 2030. They got a rover onto Mars, but apparently a dust storm or some other disturbance has rendered its solar panels inoperative, so it can't really communicate. And this is a really important one. It's building a commercial spaceport in Djibouti. That serves a couple different purposes. Now, you've heard of the Belt and Road, and Road campaign, which is basically China investing in ports, in highways, in rail, and other infrastructure around the world as part of an influence operation, right? They're trying to buy goodwill with all these different countries, buy goodwill and buy influence. So they're building a spaceport in Djibouti, which is both meant to promote commercial space activity and boost its influence. So it's been enormously active in terms of space. The report also makes it clear that we're in a strange time with regard to space. There are more and more countries getting involved in space. You know, UAE, the United Arab Emirates, recently launched a mission. They're planning another one as well. They've launched satellites and explorers. There are a lot of satellites out there, including a lot of dead satellites. You know, funny, let me just I'll shut up after this one anecdote. About 20 years ago, I was talking to a space analyst from a think tank in D.C., and they ran a bunch of thought exercises. One of the ones that they ran was, what would happen if North Korea fired a rocket straight up into space, packed with ball bearings, and at some altitude, the thing explodes and sends, you know, thousands of ball bearings in all directions in orbit. Mm. You know, how much of the satellite structure would that take out, for example?
Yeah.
So this has been on the docket for a long time here in D.C., but this latest State Department document, I thought it was pretty interesting.
Yeah, it's so fascinating. And I wanted to ask, and you actually answered the question already, in terms of kind of this a different form of economic influence. We know China's been trying to assert the diplomatic influence, the belts and roads that you mentioned, investment and mining and economics and all of that. This is one more area that's clearly playing out. Just in our last minute here, Olivier, as you look at kind of the what is next component to this, what is it that you're going to be watching?
On space policy, well, I do want to see whether China makes progress on that moon mission, the manned moon mission, I mean, because there's a push in the United States to get back to the moon as well. What I'm looking for is any sign of global cooperation rules of the road is the wrong word since we're in space, but but you know, there are debates ongoing now about what are some things we can agree on. you know, the Space Force commander recently said that we are ready to fight in space. Well, I think everyone's hoping that does not happen. But so there are questions about, like, could you reach some kind of an agreement where, you know, different manned missions to the moon can coexist? Like, this is our space, this is your space. You know, we're not going to intrude on your research area. You don't intrude on ours. Is there going to be some kind of awkward coexistence? It's bound to be awkward because the United States and China are absolutely rivals for global influence and power. But is there going to be some kind of awkward coexistence, or are we really heading for, you know, the Wild West and the New Frontier?
Yeah. Or do we create a section of Switzerland on the moon? That could be the, next thing.
Right. Exactly. Exactly.
Great insight, as always, Olivier Knox, national political correspondent for The Washington Post, anchor of the Daily 202 that we always rely on. And, Olivia, we appreciate you jumping on today, as always. Great perspective. This one's going to be a really fascinating one. It is the new frontier, the next frontier, going back to the moon.
Final frontier.
Yeah, and the final
frontier, famously.
There we go. Awesome. Olivia, thanks so much for joining us today.
It's my pleasure.
All right. That's Olivier Knox. Always appreciate him jumping on. That's going to be a fascinating one to watch. The space race and chase, what that means coming up, that's going to be a real challenge for sure. All right. We're going to step aside for some bottom of the hour news. When we come back, we're going to take a look at humanitarian efforts, relief in Turkey following the aftermath. Bishop Waddell from The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints will join us next.
Inside Sources.
Inside Sources.
America's voice of reason. Boyd Matheson.
On Utah's home for elevated conversation.
Inside Sources on KSL News Radio.
On February 6th, over 50,000 people perished in Turkey and Syria with a magnitude 7.8 and then a 7.5 earthquake struck. And in that kind of devastation, countries really find out who their friends are, who actually can step up, who can stand in, who can truly provide relief. One of those organizations that has been playing a significant role in the Turkey area and even into Syria is the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And we're very pleased to have joining us on the program today Bishop W. Christopher Waddell, first counselor in the presiding bishopric of the Church of Jesus Christ. And Bishop Waddell, thank you for joining us. And I know you actually had the opportunity recently to actually spend a couple of days in Turkey. And give us a little sense of what you saw on the ground.
Oh, absolutely. And Boyd, thank you for having me on to be able to share some of this. I was able to arrive in Turkey. We arrived on the 9th of June in Istanbul, and on the morning of the 10th of June, we flew into an area, a city called Antakya, if I'm pronouncing that right, in Turkey. And it's in a region called the Hatay region. And it was just one city of many that were impacted. But the closest thing I could describe it to, Boyd, would be pictures that I've seen. Obviously, I wasn't there, but pictures I've seen of cities like Dresden, Germany, that were bombed in World War II. Mm. You know, we've seen those pictures and of just the total devastation. And that's the closest I can describe it to. By the time we got there, much of the areas had been cleaned up. Buildings that had collapsed entirely had been cleared out. And so you would see these large lots where buildings had been. And what wasn't down completely will have to be taken down, because all the buildings that were still standing looked like they were a few hundred years old and in disrepair and falling apart, and they had been buildings that had been used just a few months before, you know, the day before the earthquake, where people lived and people worked, and all of those buildings ultimately are going to have to be razed. Wow. Because they cannot be repaired.
Wow. And when you look at that kind of displacement of so many people at once. We know this is an area that's had a lot of refugees coming across from Syria anyway. As you saw that, give me some sense of the emotion of that. Some of those folks not only lost homes there, some of them were on their, you know, second or third temporary home. And now to have to begin and rebuild again, give us a sense of your view of the people, what they're going through, how are they moving things forward?
You mentioned the Syrians in particular, and we had an opportunity to visit a, for lack of a better term, a tent city. And just let me back up a little bit on this, Boyd. The people that are displaced, and again, because of the destruction, virtually no one has a home to live in. And so there are people living in containers that are about 7 feet by 23 feet, and they can house up to 7 people. And there are container cities, and we visited one where there are probably 3,000 to 3,500 people. And these would be Turkish citizens for the most part. Mm-hmm. They have little, inside these containers, they have a washer and dryer. They have a little kitchenette. They have places, obviously, for them to sleep. And that's primarily the Turkish citizens. The Syrians are, for the most part, in tent cities because there are not enough containers for everyone. They're looking for a few hundred thousand containers. And so everyone, for the most part, is either in a tent or in containers. But these Syrians that you mentioned, these are people that fled Syria because of the civil war that was going on there. And they moved to Turkey and other places. But those that came to Turkey started in tent cities in Turkey before they were able to get their feet on the ground and get established and get into homes, apartment buildings. And not long after that, the earthquake hit, and now they're back in tents again. Oh. And so we visited one with about 2,000 inhabitants, maybe about 750 to 800 tents. And they do provide them with food, with water, fresh water, because all the infrastructure has been destroyed for the most part. And so there's very little drinking water available. And so you have huge trucks bringing in loads of bottles of drinking water for them. They have areas for mental health, tents established where people can talk to them that are suffering from trauma through all of this. It really is a remarkable thing. They're, you know, watching the children running around and playing and not realizing what's going on. And you see some of the despair in the parents' eyes, wanting to provide for their families and not really being able to. There's no place for them to work, and there's no place else to go other than the tents. Mm. But they're surviving, and eventually they're going to have places to live, containers. They're going to move them in, and the government's working to start building again homes and apartment buildings for people to move into. But it's going to be a few years before that happens.
Yeah, talk about the ultimate test of resilience. I think that is an amazing testament to just to that resilience of the human spirit. And as you were talking, Bishop Waddell, I was thinking of there's a saying that, you know, beginning empty-handed and alone frightens the best of us, but it mm-hmm. also shows how confident you are in God and in the future. And I know as part of your visit there to Turkey, that you were able to help provide relief and to give them some hope. Give us a sense of the scope. I think it's hard for people to really appreciate the extent of the relief being shared through the church and through partner organizations. But help us get a picture of that.
Turkey is found within the area called the Europe Central Area. And in every area of the world has an area welfare manager, and that works under the direction of the Welfare and Self-Reliance Services Department at headquarters. And so the area welfare manager out of Europe Central had already been on the ground in Turkey. And I have to mention this part of it that was really kind of interesting. You see the hand of the Lord in this. There's a couple, the Hubers, they're from Switzerland, and they're serving as service missionaries in the Europe Central area. And Brother Huber was a Peter Huber is his name, and he had been responsible in Switzerland for emergency relief in Switzerland, and he was an expert on how to provide relief during earthquakes or following an earthquake, and what to do and how to reach out and in emergency response. And it just so happens he was in the Europe Central area. He'd only been there a few weeks, and he was dispatched to Turkey and was able to speak to government employees. They knew who he was. They knew his background. And doors were opened to have the church provide relief. It had been a number of years that Turkey had actually turned down church relief for perhaps religious reasons, primarily a Muslim country. But because of Peter Huber going in, the church was allowed to come in and provide assistance. Mm. And so at this point, it's been multi-million dollars of assistance, primarily in food, water, hygiene. But in addition to that, the church is providing some of the containers. I was able to sign an agreement with them while we were there to provide 500 containers, and we're looking at many more, and that's just a start. But in addition to that, we met with an organization. It's AFAD. They pronounce it AFAD, and that's their version of FEMA. It's mm-hmm. it's their national agency relief organization. And we were able to meet with them in their headquarters and share with them what we were doing. And they were able to share with us and show us what the church had done and where the resources had gone to help. In particular, we've provided some mobile medical clinics in areas where hospitals had been destroyed. And so we were able to go and visit one of those and to see how that's working in areas where, again, they had no hospital service at all. They asked for another one, And we were able to meet with the organization that provides those and pay for those. And they'll have a fifth that will be put up very soon in areas where they just don't have the medical help.
Oh, that's so important. And I want to back up just a second, Bishop Waddell, because I want our listeners to just recognize what you just described with this brother Huber and having a relationship. We often talk about the difference between a transaction and a relationship is so vast. And this is a classic example of, had this just been a transaction between the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints and the Turkey government, it wasn't really going, wasn't really happening. But when there's a relationship, then everything changes. And I think that's an important part of the way the church does humanitarian aid, does provide relief, is that it's not just a transaction of a container or goods or whatever it might be. It's about building those relationships. We know there's been over $13.5 million in aid as of early April on those 20 relief projects. But give us a sense, Bishop Waddell, in terms of some of those relationships and some of the things you're seeing moving forward that are going to be a continuing part of how the church doesn't just provide it as a transaction, but sticks around and stays when things get really hard over the long haul.
Well, actually, it's interesting. That was one of the things they talked about in Turkey, and recognizing that the church will be there, that we will continue with them. We met in the first area we met in Antakya. We met with some government officials there. There are a number of areas. They're called assistant governors is their title in English. But their concern was that we might be there and then take off. And they're seeing that we have staying power there because of those relationships. And they expressed great appreciation, knowing that we are continuing. It wasn't one of those items where we came in and said, you know, here's some help. The fact that we continued to be there months after, and we continue to work with them on other items going forward, looking at additional containers, looking at even the tents, looking at additional medical facilities. There's even one aspect of this, and I think this is part of the relationship that they shared. I thought was really sweet. When we asked what else can we do, they mentioned that on June 28th, for whatever reason, that date has special meaning in Turkey. But that's a day in Turkey where all children receive a new set of clothing, and they put new clothing on all over the country. Mm. And they said that this year, the children will be sad because they won't have that. And so they turned to us to see, is there anything you can do about that? And so because of our humanitarian efforts and what we have in Salt Lake at the Humanitarian Center, working with members in Europe and gathering these, we're looking at ways that we can provide clothing, probably not for every child in Turkey, but for thousands of children who wouldn't otherwise have that opportunity. And they got a little emotional when we mentioned that we would be happy to help with something like this, to be able to bless the children who really are suffering and have so little. Many are orphans, having lost parents in the earthquakes. Mm-hmm. But the fact that we have that relationship and that they know we'll be there, it really makes a tremendous difference.
We're going to stay with the conversation just a little bit longer. Stick around. We're going to come back with Christopher Waddell, member of the presiding bishop, first counselor in the presiding bishopric of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. More not only on his trip to Turkey and relief there, but other relief projects around the world. More inside sources coming up next. Stay with us.
Boyd Matheson divides rage from reason on Inside Sources.
Continuing my conversation with Bishop Christopher Waddell, first counselor in the presiding bishopric for the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, about the church's humanitarian work in Turkey. He recently visited there. I asked Bishop Waddell if there was anything else that we should be thinking about when it comes to Turkey.
One of the items, I think anything that people donate to the humanitarian fund of the church, where obviously the donations that come in from members of the church throughout the world are used wisely, and in this particular case, through these different organizations in Turkey. And there are some things we're doing, not just directly with the Turkish government, but you mentioned relationships. One of the things we recognize that as a church worldwide, globally, we're not large, from a population standpoint. And so we recognize that the resource that we have, we're not always able to get them to some of the places where they need to go. And so we have relationships with organizations such as World Food Program, as an example. where we've made donations, and they're on the ground, and they can get to places where we really can't get because we just don't have the infrastructure. And so we're able to work with them. And they, the Red Cross, we just had a meeting yesterday with Gail McGovern, who's the CEO of Red Cross, who was expressing appreciation for what the church does. And so it's these relationships that we have with larger NGOs that we're able to vet, and we know they're good, and they can get to places, and they can do things that we just can't do. And so we work with them on very specific kind of issues, such as what's happening in Turkey right now. And so for those who are listening, the people there are, just because the earthquake is over, it doesn't mean the people aren't suffering. And they still are facing tremendous challenges. You know, and you even mentioned, they talked about, 50,000 deaths. They actually believe that the death toll could be well over a million. They just don't have a way to count everyone because of the incredible destruction that took place. Wow. And so there are many people who aren't in homes, who are in tents, who are in containers, and they're hanging on, and they're surviving because of the donations and the support that others can make, including those from the church.
So important. And we often talk about doing something that makes a difference, that never underestimate any help that can be offered or aid rendered or something donated or contribution, how that can be magnified and really leveraged. And Bishop Bordella, I want to expand just a little bit the conversation as part of a worldwide church looking at so many different areas around the world that need relief. Give us a sense of some of the relationships that you have built and some of the impact the church has been able to have for areas all around the world.
Mm-hmm. I mentioned the World Food Program. That's a tremendous agency. It's a UN agency that is all over. Their goal is to put themselves out of business. In other words, that there wouldn't be anyone that is lacking food that goes hungry. And so we have a very close working relationship with them when there are issues around the world. We also work, as I mentioned, with the Red Cross, but there are other organizations. Water for People is another organization that looks to provide clean drinking water in areas around the world, in Sub-Saharan Africa and in other organizations. We work with medical organizations as well, organizations called MedGlobal and others, where they go to areas. I remember I visited a site in the Caribbean where it was the International Medical Group, International Medical Corporation, IMC, and they were in the Bahamas after they had some tremendous earthquakes there, or not earthquakes, but typhoons and hurricanes. And where things had been wiped out and they were looking for medication and medicinal supplies, and we were there to help provide that for them. And so whatever the needs are, we have the opportunity to assist. And one other thing that's happening, I mentioned the Europe Central area. The church is divided into 14 international areas around the world, and each area has an area presidency. And a lot of the work that's being done from a humanitarian standpoint is being directed locally in those areas. The area presidencies and each area welfare manager is able to look to provide support and assistance in the various areas around the world, whether it's Europe or Asia or Africa or Latin America, to provide that assistance. One other thought, if I may mention, the Relief Society General Presidency of the Church has been given responsibility by the First Presidency to do what they can to alleviate malnutrition amongst member children around the world and those who are not members of the church. But they're starting in places like the Philippines, where the children aren't hungry, but they're malnourished in many cases, where their stomachs are full of rice, but they're not getting the nutrition they need. And so we're working with organizations to teach and train and help parents to know how to provide the appropriate nutrition for their children, not just to fill their stomachs. And so those are the kind of things that are taking place around the world that aren't really publicized anywhere, but are happening everywhere.
That's so important. And that principle, to me, it's the ultimate of the old biblical story of the widow's mite. And I've often thought that we miss a vast majority of that story. I'm pretty sure before the widow went to cast her mite in, she probably stopped off at a neighbor that was sick and delivered a loaf of bread to a new mother, and it might have been her turn to sweep and clean up the synagogue And her donation was sort of the last thing. It was an extension of who she was. But she was also really wise because she could have just given her mite to someone in need, and that would have been a transaction. But she recognized that combining it, bringing it together, would expand it and multiply it and extend the reach to many others. And I think the widow was very wise in not looking for a transaction, which might have made her feel good for a moment, but to be part of a greater story. And I think that's what the presiding bishopric, what we've seen through the Relief Society as well, I think those are all crucial components that have a global reach that I think many don't see because it's not in front of cameras and spotlights, but it's the hard work and heavy lifting of serving your fellow man and helping a neighbor in need.
Boyd, you mentioned the widow's mite. Just a quick thought about that. We recognize that the donations that come to the church from church members around the world are sacred. And there are large donations, there are small donations, there is the widow's mite, and that's real that takes place. And so we have a responsibility to make sure that as we use those resources from a humanitarian standpoint, that we're not just writing a check to anyone who says we need help, but that we work with organizations that we have vetted very carefully that can get resources to places that we just don't have the infrastructure to get it to. And we then follow up with them, whether it happens to be, you know, immunizations for malaria. That's one that's coming up through the UN, through UNICEF. They've had some situations where they've asked, or whether it is getting food to where it needs to get through the World Food Program, or organizations such as ADRA, which is the Seventh-day Adventist Relief Organization, or Catholic Relief Services. There are wonderful organizations that we can trust, that we've worked with. And we know that these resources, the widow's mite that we care for here and we have a responsibility for, actually gets to where it needs to be and is not wasted. You know, it would be, again, very easily just to write checks everywhere. But we want to make sure that the resources get to where they need to get and bless the lives they are meant to bless.
Bishop Christopher Waddell, we appreciate you so much taking time with us today as first counselor in the presiding bishop of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints and your important work in doing what we challenge people to do every day, do something that makes a difference. This is a great example from Turkey and all around the world. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, boy, thank you for having us on and for all the work you're doing. We appreciate it very much.
And that's Bishop Christopher Waddell, first counselor in the presiding bishopric of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. The devastation in Turkey, of course, has been great. Over $13.5 million already spent by the church in that area. But the important thing is the relationship and the staying power to make sure that it's not just a dollar, it's making a long-term difference. That wraps up hour number one of Inside Sources here on KSL News Radio. We'll step aside for top of the hour news. Much more to come. In Inside Sources here. Stick around. We'll be right back.
KSL FM Midvale, KSL Salt Lake City. Listen on the KSL News Radio app and in your car at 102.7 FM. KSL News Radio, your all-day companion for news. Inside Sources.
Inside Sources.
America's voice of reason. Boyd Matheson.
On Utah's home for elevated conversation.
Inside Sources on KSL News Radio.
Well, members of Congress are in the middle of a procedural vote, a crucial procedural vote on the debt ceiling deal. The vote is very close right now, and we're not sure how this is all going to play out over the next few moments. And so we're going to bring in someone who understands this, can help us navigate all of that, because if this procedural hurdle becomes a tripping point for the deal, what happens to the debt limit deal and where do we go from here? So let's begin.
Think you know the news of the day? Think again with Boyd Matheson on KSL News Radio.
All right, this is live radio at its best. James Wallner is joining us on the line. We always appreciate James' perspective on all of this. A flurry of activity going on. And James, I'm going to give you the update since I know you have other duties that you're in the middle of as well. Currently, we have 160 Republican yay votes on this rule that would advance the bill. We have 168 no votes, all Democrats, and about 106 votes still outstanding. And so first, for our listeners, James, just explain, what is it that they're voting on right now, and why is it so crucial to the process?
Well, thanks for having me. I feel so relevant. I feel like I'm doing like traffic or the weather, like stuff that's happening in real time that affects people's lives. No, it's really simple. The House, just like the Senate, they have rules that govern how they debate bills, who can speak, how long they can speak, can they offer amendments, those types of things. But those rules are cumbersome in the view of the members, and so therefore they waive those rules all the time. The Senate, they do it by unanimous consent, and the House, they do it by a special rule. They adopt a new rule or a new set of rules for a debate, just like this debt limit debate, instead of going by the House rules. And so the House rules will say every member can speak for an hour, for instance, and everybody can offer amendments. Well, this rule says that all 435 members combined can speak for 1 hour total altogether, and no one can offer amendments. Mm. And so the rules are a way to make it more convenient for the members and the leaders, and maybe not necessarily for the American people, but certainly for the lawmakers.
Yeah, and then I think that's why there's been a lot of protest around what is the rule. We know it was a very close vote even to get this out of committee. Thomas Massie, of course, ended up being the deciding vote there to move it out, as he felt there were some things in there that could actually trim some spending for a change, and so he went ahead and voted for that. So give us the process here. We're looking. There's still about 100 votes outstanding. Clearly, there will either need to be a shift in some of those Republican votes or some of the Democrats are going to have to help out, which they said they just simply didn't want to do. But talk to us about that, James, in terms of kind of tradition. Usually it's the majority party that leads out on a new rule like this. Is this one that could be different than historical? What does this look like?
Well, the rule vote is usually a party line vote. You're absolutely correct. And the Democrats aren't going to be very excited about helping out the Republicans, even if they do support some of the underlying provisions in this debt limit bill and want to raise the debt limit. But that gives conservative Republicans, or moderates for that matter, it gives individual Republicans a lot of leverage on the rule vote. Because if you only have 3 votes to lose, or 4 votes, or 2 votes to lose, You all of a sudden, if you're one of 5 members who's banded together and saying we are not going to vote for this rule unless you give us X, then they're going to listen to you. But at the end of the day, I think you're right. The Democrats are going to, I think, hold their nose if they have to and switch their votes and vote for this rule if it looks like it could go down, at least enough of them to make sure that it passes. So I don't know if it will go down, but, you know, I should never predict the future like that on, you know, live radio, because it probably could go down right now. Who knows?
But
that's the dynamic I expect.
Yeah, but you're so relevant, James. We're going to get you your own sounder, a special, you know, breaking news sounder for James Wallner appearance on the show. So let's walk through this scenario. If they don't hold their nose, because currently you have 25 Republicans voting no on this rule, if this were to go down, then what?
Well, then the Democrats, others could propose a rule of their own, like, or they could just proceed under the House rules. Of course, what would happen is that the Speaker, Kevin McCarthy, would recess the House subject to the call of the chair, and they would have a lot of, flurried, frenzied negotiations behind closed doors, forgetting that they have rules on the books that have been on the books for the past 5 months, that we've been living under this extraordinary measures debt limit sort of Damocles moment, right? I mean, we have a process, and that process has worked for the American Republic going back in various ways and to different, you know, levels of detail, and it hasn't always been great, but it works. The rules work. The institution works, and it's worked since 1789.
Yeah, and that's an important thing to keep in mind, is that this has worked for a long time, and sometimes it's messy. Sometimes it's a little painful to watch, but it does continue to work, and that is the magnificence and the miracle, I think, of the constitutional republic. I know that a lot of the Democrats, again, don't want to cast a vote on this one. Some of them are going to be willing to do it on the final bill. Clearly, this is a high priority for President Biden. He's declaring some victories in this. The Republicans are declaring some victories in this. So what does that look like Is the president going to start to assert some pressure on Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries to say, hey, let's not make this rules process get even muddier and messier. We need some of your votes now to make sure we get this thing to the floor.
Well, this is a good piece of advice for any of your listeners who will find themselves one day sitting in one of those seats in Congress behind a Senate desk or behind on a House bench, right? And that is, if you vote no and you don't want to vote for the bill or the rule or whatever it is that you voted against, you should vote no and you should run as fast as you possibly can away from the House floor and away from the Senate floor, because what will happen is just like with the Medicare Part D vote, which was held open for hours, just like with, we've seen this time and time again in the House and the Senate, but the entire world will come down on you and you will see like a scrum of people around someone and that person will be sitting there. And yes, there's a lot of leverage in that moment, but I think we can all remember back to high school or to any social setting where all of our peers were surrounding us and urging and yelling at us and being nice or mean or whatever, and asking us to do something. And in that moment, regardless of how strong your convictions are, it is extraordinarily difficult to hold out. It takes a special kind of individual to hold out in that moment. And so what I would advise lawmakers, if they are voting the way that their constituents want them to vote, the way that their conscience dictates that they vote, I would advise them to vote no and not put themselves in that situation. However, there is also a lot of leverage in that situation. You can get a lot of stuff in those moments that you can't otherwise get in other moments. But in order to get it, you have to ultimately vote yes.
Yeah, that's right. And that's the that's going to be the fascinating thing to watch here in the next few moments. So currently it is straight party line in terms of the Democrats. None of them have chosen to support this rule on the debt limit and federal spending bill. We are currently about 60 votes yet to be cast. So this is where I think it will get really interesting as we come down the home stretch and see how that plays out. And so just describe for us a little bit, James, because you've been in the room where it happens in these kinds of things, and whether it's on the floor, kind of being encircled by your colleagues, or if it's in one of those notorious rooms behind closed doors, what are the conversations likely to be like in this setting today?
Well, they're probably a lot more disappointing and underwhelming than we would otherwise think. People saying a lot of things like, if we, and we heard this, the previews of these conversations were happening on the floor prior to the vote in these remarks that the members were giving. If we don't do this, then China is going to become the world's reserve currency. Well, you know, I mean, maybe, maybe not. Maybe if we keep going along the path that we are, China will become the world's reserve currency anyway, right? Like, there's lots of different stuff that they're going to be arguing to get members to vote yes. But ultimately, just a little dose of common sense can really help and assist members in sifting through all of that stuff. The problem is, when you're in that pressure cooker, when you are in that crucible of conflict, it becomes extraordinarily difficult for people to kind of separate fact from fiction in that way.
So important. James Waldner pulling over to the side of the road to help us make sure we can navigate all of this. Again, it is still no Democrats are in support of this. The Republicans still appear to have to get it across the line. 26 no votes coming out of the Republicans. The shot clock is expired, but as we know in the House, they'll keep that open until the numbers add up the way they want. James, thanks so much for joining us today, and we'll have a special sounder for you when you come on next time.
Well, thanks for having me. This must be what being a sports commentator feels like. There's something happening, and we're like, come on, this is great.
Great stuff as always. James Waldner, one of the great friends of the show, and always has the right perspective. What's going on behind the scenes? We're going to keep watching that as we roll through hour number two of Inside Sources here on KSL News Radio. We'll be right back.
Think again on Inside Sources with Boyd Matheson. Get deeper insights on the news from Inside Sources.
Well, many think the U.S. economy is weaker today than it's ever been. As a result, politicians on the right and the left have embraced a protectionist approach to trade and the economy. And Americans are pretty pessimistic about the future, but are we really worse off today? And is our free and open economic system really working? I'm really pleased to have back on the program with us Scott Lincecum, Vice President of General Economics at Cato Institute, and very important, he's also the author of Capitalism at the Dispatch, and a great piece talking about the American wealth machine and some of the misguided discontents. And Scott, welcome back to the show.
Oh, thanks for having me.
This is a great one to get beyond the headline, kind of a think again moment in terms of where we are really. So we know there's a lot of doom and gloom out there, but What's the reality? Where are we?
The reality is that by all sorts of metrics, per capita gross domestic product, innovation, universities, you name it, on and on and on, the United States remains a real global leader in both being one of the wealthiest countries on the planet, but also one of the most productive in not just things we think of like tech and the internet and AI now, but also in manufacturing productivity and, you know, whether it's aerospace or automotive. And at the same time, most Americans are far better off today than we were, you know, a few decades ago, even though most of our politicians are out there, of course, promising to make America great again or to, you know, have a more worker-focused economic policy harkening back to the 1970s or the 1950s. Reality is we really don't want to go back to that, that the U.S. economy is doing pretty darn well these days, particularly versus our global peers.
All right. And I want to get into some of the things that you wrote in the Dispatch as you address this, because you really went through a lot of the things that, again, are great headlines or great clickbaity kinds of things. But the reality seems to be a little bit different in terms of where we are. And so just give us a couple of examples of areas where the doom and gloom makes it sound pretty bad, but the reality maybe shows us a little different.
Well, sure. The most obvious place to start is gross domestic products, the amount of stuff we're producing every year. So back in 1990, the share of world GDP, the United States share, was about 25%. Today, it's still 25%, despite China's rise and Japan's fall. Meanwhile, the poorest U.S. state in Mississippi actually has a higher average income than a place like France. Which I think is a really good indication of just how rich the United States is and how most Americans are. But it goes beyond that. You know, we continue to lead the world in patenting, in R&D spending, in corporate leadership. Again, not just in tech, but in all sorts of fields. Of having some of the largest and biggest and best companies in the world. And then even for America's poor, the story is pretty good. So if you take incomes adjusted for inflation in the lowest one-fifth of the workforce, that's risen by 74% since 1990. Again, so adjusting for inflation. That means that Americans in our poorest Americans are 74% richer than they were back in 1990. And you can go on and on. We spend more per pupil on education. We lead the world in venture capital investment. We're home to 11 of the world's 15 top-ranked universities. I mean, I can do this all day. I mean, the fact is that in important metric after important metric, the United States remains really a global champion.
So important. I'm going to get to the doom and gloom. I just want to real quickly, we're keeping our eye on the debt ceiling vote. This is the procedural vote. Currently, they have topped that 218 mark. 31 Democrats have voted for the measure. 29 Republicans voted against. It's still open, so there'll probably be some more switching. But it appears that this rule will pass, setting up a final vote into the evening tonight. And so kind of staying on the party line there. So with all that good news that you just shared with us in terms of everything from Mississippi being better than France on a number of those economic spaces to universities and innovation and patents and all of that, why are we stuck in this doom and gloom then?
Well, I mean, I think there are a couple of things going on. First is that it's undoubtedly true that the United States has gone through some rough patches over the last, say, 35 years. You know, there's three major recessions in 2000, then the Great Recession, then the pandemic. And recessions, of course, collapse economic output. They cause incomes to go backwards. And that sticks in people's heads. So you'll hear that, you know, for example, millennials weren't doing as well as the baby boomers or the Gen Xers in terms of wealth and home ownership. But most of those analyses basically looked at, you know, just a few years after the Great Recession, when everybody had struggled. So when you take a longer term view and, you know, sticking with the millennials, now when you extend that through, say, 2021, you see that millennials are actually as rich or richer than their counterparts in previous generations. So that's the first thing. You know, we tend to take these snapshots of time that don't account for short term fluctuations. But another big thing is what I would call its relative wealth, or how we feel relative to our peers. The fact is that even if you're doing better than, say, your parents were, or better than you were 20, 30 years ago, a lot of Americans will look to their neighbors or people in their social circles who are doing even better, and they'll compare themselves to that and think, well, you know what, actually, I'm not doing so hot. And so there's a kind of a built-in pessimism that comes from, you know, when we compare ourselves to others. And of course, you know, social media and the keeping up with the Joneses mindset on a lot of TV and movies, we see, you know, those the ultra rich doing so much better, and we think, oh, well, I must be struggling. And so, you know, those types of perceptions, I think, are very difficult to combat with more statistics. I mean, I can throw as many charts and graphs and numbers as at a person as possible, but if they don't feel that, yeah, if they think things are worse, then they're, you know, it's going to be tough for me to convince them, regardless of, you know, what the data say. And then the last thing I think is we have this thing called the hedonic treadmill, which is just a really simple or complicated way of a simple concept. You know, we tend to kind of bank all the benefits of living in this modern globalized world. And we tend to focus on kind of the bad things that are happening to us. Whereas when we think back to the good old days when we were kids, we tend to only remember the good things, and we tend to forget all the bad stuff that went along with it. So, you know, that type of nostalgia, I think, is the last thing that really breeds this sort of pervasive economic pessimism. And it's a pessimism that, unfortunately, a lot of politicians are all too willing to take advantage of, because they can promise that they'll make things better, right? That their opponents have been terrible. Their opponents are the cause for all the problems. And of course, if you elect them, they'll solve them all.
That is fantastic analysis. Scott Linsicum, the Vice President of General Economics at Cato's Herbert A. Stifel Center for Trade Policy Studies, also the author of Capitalism at the Dispatch. That's where this piece is. And as you pointed out, Scott, it is the system. There's always going to be the ups and downs, but the pillars of economic, legal, and political really has created this perpetual national wealth machine that we all have been able to, even though it sputters at times, it does have the great staying power there as well. Scott, thanks so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
All right, that's Scott Linsicum from Cato, and this is a great piece because, again, you hear the headlines, things are so bad, things are so awful. If you get underneath the headline, it's not so bad. The American economy sputters, has challenges and problems, but the pillars keep everything driving forward. And some of the things that may surprise you in terms of how good we really have it and how good things really are. And, of course, it's a matter of just making them better moving forward. All right, we'll step aside for some bottom of the hour news. Coming back, we'll make sure we dig into what has happened. We should have a closed vote on the rule in the House that will set up a final vote on the debt ceiling and spending bill coming up tonight. Stick around. More Inside Sources coming up next.
Inside Sources.
Inside Sources.
America's voice of reason. Boyd Matheson.
On Utah's home for elevated conversation.
Inside Sources on KSL News Radio.
Well, President Biden's the clear frontrunner, of course, for the Democratic Party ahead of 2024. But he does have two contenders in the field and a few other rumblings out there. Recent polling shows that these contenders are on the map, and they actually have some pretty high favorability ratings, at least higher than the president's. So, of course, we know it's not just the polling. It's also the process and what you have on the ground. But we want to take a look at what does this actually mean to President Biden? What do those headwinds look like? What do they really feel like? And, of course, we turn to Carly Kupperman, CEO and partner of Schoen Kupperman Research. Carly, welcome back to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
All right. So given some of the polling from the president, just in terms of favorability, give us a perspective in terms of what you see there, and then let's compare and contrast it with those that are at least attempting to give the president a run for his money.
Yeah, look, Biden's favorability is dropping. He has had some low ratings for quite some time at this point. He had low ratings going into the midterm elections, which didn't seem to matter in terms of the results there. But his ratings have continued to drop and or remain low. And, I think to some extent that it's due to what is going on in the country, the economy. There's still pain points, inflation is still high. And then, everything that was going on with the debt ceiling, all of these things impact how voters feel towards the country and then certainly towards the president who is in charge. And yet it seems like there's this never ending, continuation of instability that is happening. So, Biden has suffered from low ratings. We've seen time and time again in polling that there really is not a lot of enthusiasm towards his presidential candidacy and running for reelection. And yet we've also seen that it does seem like Democrats generally, I guess, reluctantly intend to support him, though, not in their entirety.
Yeah. And I think that's always kind of that consolidation that usually happens as things get a little more serious as you go along. Give us some sense, though, in terms of what Robert F. Kennedy Jr. and Marianne Williamson have been able to at least put forward in terms of at least their image and likability.
Yeah, look, I mean, their favorability ratings in terms of positive ratings are somewhat similar to that of Biden's, which, certainly should be something that Biden is keeping an eye on, as he watches this field take place. And at the same time, their unfavorable ratings are much lower than Biden's. But that in large part is because voters really don't know them, and especially not the way that they have opinions about Biden. I think with RFK in particular, you're getting an association that has to do with his family name. And I think that you're also kind of seeing that I think that a lot of what's channeling towards, support we're seeing towards them is just this desire for somebody else other than Biden. And that kind of channels itself into support for one of these candidates.
Yeah. And as you look at those and as things, start to heat up once we get past Labor Day, the longer that goes or the longer the president is in kind of those low favorability ratings, does this really just end up being a campaign of choice? Is that how the president tries to frame it in terms of either a former president running again or maybe one of the others like a Governor DeSantis? Does this become much more about a choice, a directional thing, as opposed to a referendum on the president?
Yeah, look, I mean, Biden's best selling point is just, he's trying to portray himself as a choice of a competent leader, in contrast to, it makes an obvious contrast to Trump, who, has certainly generated a lot of chaos. As long as Trump is a much stronger candidate over DeSantis, I think his belief is that this is in his favor and that it's kind of okay if his ratings aren't strong as long as Trump's aren't stronger. Now, at the same time, I would say that while I don't think these Democratic primary challengers pose a serious threat at this point, he's got to be careful because if it gets to the point where they can get enough support and energy and, attention, the last thing that Biden wants to do is be in a position where he has to debate them and really give air and, fuel to their candidacies.
Yeah, that really is the test, isn't it? If he has to be on a debate stage, that starts to change the dynamic a lot. As you look at it historically, as you look at the numbers, what is it that you mentioned the midterms and the fact that the president's low approval rating didn't translate into anything for Republican momentum or what it was expected to be. What do you take out of that?
I think that when you look at presidential approval and favorability ratings, there's so much that's going into what those numbers are. And, you know, it's not like it's a good thing that Biden's ratings are so low. It's just that you're capturing all sorts of sentiments that people have in towards of, you know, their day-to-day life, how things are going, how they feel about the country, the economy, issues taking place. And it doesn't always translate into who they're going to vote for. Now, obviously, the presidential election is a much more direct connection between, you know, his approval and who they're voting for. But we have seen historically in midterms that the president's party loses many more seats than, you know, the Democrats did this time. So I think there is not this direct correlation between approval, because so much else is going into how people rate the president and then ultimately the election outcome.
Yeah. And so give me something, Carly, that you're watching for. We kind of enter this 100 days between Memorial Day and Labor Day, where we expect things to get cranked up a little bit. What from the president's side, what's it that he's going to try to be positioning? What is he going to be trying to move in terms of the numbers? What is someone like a Robert F. Kennedy looking at in terms of what he can do over the summer? What does that look like?
Yeah, look, I mean, Biden wants to be able to put this debt ceiling, situation behind him. He wants to be able to declare some kind of, you know, victory just in terms of, look, I'm moving forward. The country is still running, you know, projecting that stable and steady leadership and continuing to try to have more stability in the economy and bring down inflation. I mean, that's the angle he certainly wants to have. And I think he wants to do anything he can to consolidate support in the Democratic Party, which he already does have to some extent, but he's going to be looking to continue to use his platform to look as presidential as he can so that these primary challengers don't become any more of a threat going into the fall when things really will pick up.
Yeah, fascinating stuff as always. Carly Kupperman, always appreciate your perspective on what's actually underneath the numbers and behind the headlines. And again, Carly's the CEO and partner of Schoen Kupperman Research. Carly, thanks for joining us today.
Sure, thank you.
All right, again, that's Carly Kupperman, CEO and partner of Schoen Kupperman Research. And the thing I love about their organization is it's not just the politics of what the top line numbers are. It's what's underneath those numbers that really matter. And so while some people are wringing their hands that the president's approval numbers are so low, does that create space for a Robert Kennedy Jr. or a Marianne Williamson to build some momentum? And for those camps, that's really all they want is just a shot. They want to be able to make their case. I think what they really want is to be able to get on a debate stage with the president. I think they figure that's their best chance to actually change the dynamic in terms of voting. Because remember, getting the nomination for your party is not determined by a national poll or a national vote. It's delegate by delegate, state by state that actually gets that done. Slightly different versions of that story between the Democrats and the Republicans, but it's pretty much the same process, and it is the process. And so these numbers are interesting. They have to be somewhat concerning for the president in that they've been stuck kind of in these low approval ratings for a long time. It will be interesting to see if Mr. Kennedy or Ms. Williamson can translate some of their positives into process and people on the ground in those early states that can actually make a difference when it comes to delegates. All right, we're going to step aside for one last break. When we come back, we'll round things out and get you up to date on what's been happening in the House of Representatives, what's going to be teed up for tonight's vote on the debt ceiling and deficit spending bill. Much more Inside Sources coming up next. Stick around.
Hear elevated conversation on crucial issues. Boyd Matheson on Inside Sources.
Welcome back. Final segment of Inside Sources here on KSL News Radio. Great to be with you today, as it always is. I am Boyd Matheson. As we round out the program today, just to give you a little bit of an update, just in the last few minutes, the procedural vote, the vote on what they called the rule, passed in the House of Representatives. The vote was 241 to 187. Now, the interesting thing to note here is 29 Republicans voted against and 52 Democrats voted for. This is very rare. Usually on these rule votes, it is strictly party line. So normally you just would have had to have all of the Republicans would have had to vote for it to get it across. And so this shows you how important this vote was to President Biden. He didn't want to have to mess around with more messes in the House. And I think he communicated very clearly to the minority leader, Hakeem Jeffries, that we need to get this done today. And that's going to require some Democrats to hold their nose and to cast a vote in order to get this rules package across, teeing up what will happen later today, probably around 6:30 p.m. Mountain Time, 7 p.m., kind of in that time frame. Always things slide a little bit there in the House. That will tee up the final vote, which, again, will likely need Democratic support. I think there'll be quite a bit of it as we get into the evening. But let's break it down just a little bit in terms of what that looks like. Of course, you also have to look at what happens next, which is it gets kicked over to the Senate tomorrow and what that might look like. So we'll dig into that as well. So let's start with Speaker McCarthy. Earlier today, he was asked if he has a majority of the majority's votes. That's somewhat known as the Hassert rule. Denny Hassert was the Speaker of the House for the Republicans. And he said, if you can't get over half of your own body, your own caucus to vote for something, you probably shouldn't put it on the floor. And so that was the big question. And here's what the speaker had to say.
Do you expect a majority of the majority?
Oh, yeah.
Do you think you'll get 150 Republican votes?
That's what Jeffrey said. I haven't said any number. I know Jeffrey said, tried to set a number for us. I think we're going to do 25.
And so that was Speaker of the House Kevin McCarthy saying he's confident he has a majority of the majority. And that's sort of the longstanding unspoken rule if you're in the House of Representatives. Now, during a press conference today, Hakeem Jeffries, the minority leader, assured the American people that his conference is not fractured.
Conference is not fractured at all. I had a very good conversation with Pramila Jayapal earlier today. Unity is different from unanimity. We will continue to be unified. We are going to make sure that we avoid a default, and then we'll be unified as we move forward in building an economy that works for everyday Americans from the middle out and from the ground up.
That's a really interesting statement there from the minority leader, Hakeem Jeffries. Unity is different from unanimity. We often talk about having consensus. Consensus doesn't necessarily mean 100% agreement. Consensus is 100% support once the decision is made. And I think that's what Hakeem Jeffries was saying both to his party members and to the activists, the lobbyists that are on the Democratic side of the aisle that are saying, wait a minute, this isn't quite what we wanted. But he said it is important that we have unity. Unanimity is not what it's about. It's support for that decision once it has been made. Really interesting statement that I don't think a lot of people caught in his reference today. So that's really nice under the headline sound there regarding Hakeem Jeffries. Again, unanimity and unity are different animals. Being united in terms of the decision being made and how you get something done is really interesting. Also want to go back just a little bit. Yesterday, Hakeem Jeffries also spoke with the press, and he kind of laid out how many Republican votes are needed to get this deal actually across the line.
Initially, we heard that 95% of the House Republican Conference supports the agreement. That doesn't appear to be the case. But we also are committed to making sure occurs is that the House Republicans keep their promise to produce at least 150 votes, period, full stop.
All right. That's also a very interesting comment coming from Hakeem Jeffries saying, OK, on the final vote, Republicans, you got to deliver 150 of those votes. And then the Democrats will make up the difference in getting to that magic number in the House of Representatives, 218. And so that was an interesting shot across the bow to Kevin McCarthy. And also that is Hakeem Jeffries' positioning a little bit in terms of trying to protect as many of his members on the Democratic side of the aisle as possible from having to cast a vote that might be confusing, might be used against them in a campaign ad when they run for re-election next year. That's all the challenge of navigating this, is how much of it gets wrapped around the axle of the politics of it versus the policy of it. And that's the interesting thing to get to. So, again, as we stand now, we expect at about 7 p.m. Utah time that the House of Representatives will take a final vote on this debt ceiling and spending bill. And then if that all plays out as we expect, it will pass. There will be over 218 votes there. And then it moves across the building. They'll take it over to the other side where the Senate will take it up tomorrow. And this was interesting, a little preemptive strike from Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell today. Earlier today, they had a little gaggle after their caucus lunch. So that's one of the things you recognize in Washington. The Democrats have their lunch on Tuesday and the Republicans have their lunch on Tuesday. And they talk strategy and what's coming up on the calendar for the week. I imagine this was quite a contentious lunch, probably on both sides of the aisle, but probably more so on the Republican side. And so Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell was quick to rush to the microphone after the meeting because he wanted to frame the conversation. Again, whether you agree with it or not, this was his strategy to get out in front. And he gave comments about how deals like this are reached in divided government and when the deal might actually reach the Senate.
In divided government, in a debt ceiling situation, it's a time for negotiations. In fact, 7 out of the last 10 debt ceilings have included other items. And now the drama is in the House. We anticipate the bill passing and coming over to us as soon as tomorrow.
That Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell speaking earlier today. Again, he said 7 out of the last 10 debt ceiling raises have had other items attached to it, including some spending cuts and some reform there as well. And then finally, he also commented in this little gaggle they had after the caucus lunch today. He had comments for Republicans who are not happy with the debt ceiling deal, reporting that it doesn't go far enough.
I would say that most of my members who have objections would like to do more of the things that are already in the bill. I think Speaker McCarthy should be congratulated on capturing a number of priorities.
All right. So that's Mitch McConnell teeing up what he anticipates coming across the building. Once they get the bill done on the House side, we don't anticipate any hiccups there. It should be a pretty clean vote on that tonight. Again, that'll be happening somewhere between 6:30 and 7. So make sure you stay tuned with Jeff Kaplan's afternoon news. He's going to be watching that as that begins to unfold. We know that Speaker McCarthy is scheduled to speak at about 7 p.m. local time. My guess is they'll have the vote and then the speaker will speak and deliver on his promise to get this done and over to the Senate so it can be to the president's desk before that June 5th deadline. So a lot of machinations going on out there today, a lot of messy out there, and a lot of the conversations going on. But things have moved forward. The resolution has passed the procedural hurdle of the rules, including a number of Democrats crossing the aisle to make sure that bill on the rules gets passed. Final vote will come up about 6:30 Utah time tonight. Stay tuned for that. All right, that wraps it up for us on Inside Sources here on KSL News Radio. As always, great to be with you. I'm Boyd Matheson, and as you go out into the world today, make sure you see something that inspires, say something that uplifts, and do something today that makes a difference.
KSL FM Midvale, KSL Salt Lake City. Listen on the KSL News Radio app and in your car at 102.7 FM. KSL News Radio, your all-day companion for news.
2 years ago, Americans watched in horror as a crisis unfolded at the Kabul airport.
She was tear-gassed and beaten.
Images of thousands desperate to escape Taliban oppression filled our news feeds. More than 80,000 Afghans made it to America. But the story didn't end there.
It was very cold. There was no power, no heat.
Who would help our newest neighbors? I'm Andrea Smartin. In Stranger Becomes Neighbor, you'll hear the stories of some remarkable refugees who left their homes and their dreams behind, only to start over from zero.
Their only possession was 3 blankets.
And you'll meet Americans who stepped up to help them.
You want me to come when you deliver your baby.
What can one person do in the face of an international disaster decades in the making? That's Stranger Becomes Neighbor. Find us at kslpodcast.com. Follow us on Apple Podcasts or anywhere else you listen.